We were having to reboot the computer. That means turn it off and turn it back on for those of you who are not familiar with computers. And unfortunately, Microsoft decided to update it. So it's taking a little while to update and get back going. We're in 1 Samuel, the 13th chapter, is where our main study will be done today. But I wanted to do a little something that will perhaps bring us up to date. We planned it this way, and it would be much better, of course, with the use of the overhead. But I still call them overheads instead of computer slides. But we kept today's lesson short. It's about midway. It is a turning point in Saul's life, as you well know, a real downward turn Saul's life takes now. And we kept the lesson material, the actual new text, brief so we could do just a little bit of review. And this sort of thing goes much better when you have a PowerPoint presentation to do it. But let's do it. Just take your Bible and turn it to the first chapter in Samuel. And we're going to just simply review. Why are we here? Who is Saul? What is he doing fighting against the Philistines? Why is he the leader on this occasion? What brought us here? And the answer, of course, to that question, or those questions, is what we've studied so far in this book. So let's talk about it. There was a fellow by the name of Elkanah. He lived in the hill country of Ephraim, and he had two wives. One of them's name was Peninnah, and the other one was Hannah. Very good. The other one was Hannah. One of them was barren, the other was not. Who was barren? Hannah was barren. Peninnah had children. I don't think the text says how many. But this reminds us how often God utilizes women in teaching some important lessons about faith. And many, many times there have been in God's story, barren women whom he gave children for particular purposes to show them that the course that everything was about to follow was his will and not the will of man. And of course, we know how those stories, many of them, have developed and what they have shown to us. How did Peninnah treat Hannah? She made fun of her. She didn't sympathize with her, didn't try to console her. She taunted her and made fun of her so much that she caused Hannah to cry a great deal. Hannah then, one day on one of their trips, their annual trips to Shiloh. Shiloh was their principal place of worship. It was the center in that part of the world. And a priest named Eli presided there, but she went to the tabernacle, it probably would have been, and she prayed there for God to give her a child. And whom did he give her? Samuel. All right, he did give her a child. And by the way, as we're going through this, obviously we're going to have to go very quickly, so we'll not have time to talk about all of the wonderfully interesting details. We're just reviewing. So God gave her a child named, and she named him Samuel. What'd she do with him? God gave her a child, and she gave him back to God, didn't she? And so when he was weaned, what did she do with him? Took him back to Shiloh, to Eli, and put him in the care of Eli. So from the age of maybe four or so, he lived with Eli. They went to visit him, of course. I would take it regularly, more than once a year, but I would take it they, of course, at least once a year, did go to visit with this young one. It took a lot of faith on Hannah's part, didn't it? All of us, even us fathers, can think about what if we gave up our child at that age to God in the way that Hannah did. Most of us want to give our children back to God. We just want to do the upbringing, don't we? We don't want to let somebody else do it and out of our sight. So this took a great deal of faith and dedication to God on Hannah's part. One of the great lessons of this book comes to us, of course, from Hannah. Now, the priest at Shiloh, his name again was Eli. He had a couple of sons. Do you recall their names? Hophni, I'm not sure how to spell that, how to pronounce that fellow's name, and Phinehas. What was their character? Pardon? They were evil. They were worldly. They were out for themselves and nobody else. In this text, we're told two main things they did that expressed their evil. What was the first one mentioned? They corrupted what? They corrupted the sacrifices and the worship. Priests had a right to eat from the sacrifices, but they were abusing those privileges and corrupting the sacrifices. Second thing they did, they had sex with the women at the tabernacle, didn't they? When women came to worship there, they were having sex with them. They probably justified this. Because that was a familiar practice from the people round about them, whom they were supposed to have booted out of the country, but didn't. But they probably were copying them at that time. So, what becomes of those people? What did God say to Eli, what did he say was going to happen to Eli and his sons? All right, he said his sons were going to be killed the same day. They were going to be killed the same day, and then he's told that he would die. And we learn all of this in the first couple of chapters. We come to chapter 3 then. And Samuel is still young. We don't know just how young, but God gives him a prophecy. What is that prophecy? He's supposed to go tell somebody something. Who is he supposed to go tell? Eli. He's supposed to go tell Eli. And what's he supposed to tell Eli? Now is the time for that prophecy. God told you, and we don't know how long ago it was, but God told you a while back, this is going to happen, and now God has told me to come tell you that it's happening. It's coming. So he was eager to go tell Eli that, was Samuel? No. He didn't want to do it at all, but Eli, to his credit, absolutely insisted that Samuel tell him. Samuel did, and Eli said, so be it. This is the will of God. So again to his credit, he submitted himself to the will of God. So that's the first prophecy that Samuel spoke, and he was young. We don't know, as I said a moment ago, just how young he was. Now, in chapter 4, all of that we learn through chapter 3. We've got Eli instructing this young man. Now, Eli was a priest. This young man that we're dealing with, he bears actually, ultimately, three offices, doesn't he? He is one of the judges of Israel. He is a priest. And he is also a prophet, and we learn that beginning here in chapter 3, and we'll see him prophesying some more before he dies. Now, chapter 4 finds us in conflict with somebody. Huh? Philistines, that's right. Now, for the next good while, anytime we're at war, it's likely going to be with the Philistines, isn't it? Now, some other surrounding tribes and nations get into the action sometime, but most of the time right now, it's going to be the Philistines. How close are the Philistines and Israel together? How close are they? They abut, don't they? The borderline is on one side of it is Philistia, and on the other side is Israel. So they are neighbors then, and I mean absolute neighbors, closely. And there was a continuing battle over towns that were on the borderline. If you'll remember, there's a later scene where it says Israel and Samuel accomplished this, but he subdued the Philistines, and they stayed subdued all of his life. And they got back, it says, some of those towns that they sort of, some of the time, seemed like they swapped from one nation to the next just overnight. But what we have here, we have the Philistines, and they're in battle array, the text says, against Israel. And who wins this battle? Philistines win this battle. So the Israelites withdraw, and what do they decide will help them beat the Philistines? If they can just take the Ark of the Covenant, Neil says, out to battle, then that's going to assure them a win. Now, the Ark of the Covenant had been in some battle situations before, and it had indeed been a sign of God and His presence, and He had delivered them on other occasions. So they were not totally without precedent in taking the Ark of the Covenant. Did it work? Nope. Didn't work. They got soundly trounced again. Why didn't it work, do you think? Wasn't God's idea, and their desire to win didn't have anything to do with exalting God, did it? Their idea had to do with just delivering themselves and saving their own skin, and so they used the Ark of the Covenant as kind of a talisman, sort of a magic kind of thing. It itself was going to deliver them. But the power behind the Ark of the Covenant was God, and they were not right with God, were they? That was the problem. They were not right with God. That's why He had allowed the Philistines to come and overtake them this time and other times, defeat them. So they were not right with God. If they had been right with God, then He would have worked for them, probably would have already worked for them before they needed, they thought, the Ark of the Covenant. So that happens in chapter 4. What happens to the Ark of the Covenant? Huh? Yeah, the Philistines captured it. My, and that's a bad state of affairs, isn't it? Nothing like this. This was a sacred box. It was a box. It was overladen with gold inside and out. The text says you couldn't touch it. Those who were responsible for carrying it had to do so by putting poles through rings on either side of it. And they were sort of pallbearers, if you will, of the Ark of the Covenant. What was in the Ark of the Covenant? It was just an empty box? No, it had some symbols of God's care for them, didn't it? That's what it had, some reminders of God's care for them. It had the table of the commandments, right? It had something from Aaron, a rod that had, I mean, just a stick. Janie's got a stick in the car. And nothing ever happens with it unless you whack me with it. That's about the only thing that comes of it. It doesn't bud. But that's what happened with Aaron's rod. Here, just an old dead dry stick came to life, didn't it? And then we had a third thing that God had provided for Israel. The manna that he had fed them with, a sample of it, in the wilderness. So the Philistines took it, and they took it first to Ashdod. There were five main Philistine cities, and each one of them kind of had what they would have called probably its prince or its king. And they took it to Ashdod. And what happened to it at Ashdod? What happened to them is a better question, isn't it? Where did they put it? All right, they put it in the temple of their god. What was their god's name? Dagon. He was their god, and they put it in his house. What happened? They put it in there. Next day they came in. What did they find? Yeah, the Dagon, the big statue of Dagon, had toppled over, hadn't it? How does that happen? Well, they upratted him again. It's funny, if he was a real god, why didn't he upright himself? But we'll not go into that. They upratted him and came in the next day, and what had happened? He was toppled over again, but he was busted in pieces, wasn't he? So, and then God smote them with, what? Just in simple terms, with tumors, didn't he? Boils. It depends on your translation, how it's rendered, but none of them sound very fun. But he smote them with tumors and plagues, and these were deadly. And so Ashdod wanted to do what? And suddenly this thing, this box they were so eager to get, it was hot. A hot potato. They wanted to get rid of it. So they sent it to where? Gath, one of the other of the five cities of the Philistines. And what happened at Gath? Same thing. All of these plagues killing people. And so Gath decides what? Yeah, get it out of here. You're killing us. So they send it to Ekron, don't they? Well, what happens at Ekron? Same thing. We're just having reruns here, aren't they? So the whole country of Philistia is distraught. I mean, they're dying. They're suffering. And we can smile about it, but it's a really serious, serious thing there. So when they won in the battle against Israel, and when they won and took the Ark of the Covenant, they didn't so much win, did they? God, all by himself, without Israel's help at all, defeated the Philistines. So what did they decide to do with it? Yeah, let's send this thing home. Let's get rid of it. Get it out of here. And that's what they did. We're told that they got a couple of oxen, a couple of cows, and they loaded it on a wagon. And they did play one little game. Do you recall? They put them on the road back to a town, nearby town. I forget the name of it just now. But they put it on the road home, and they said, what? If they go straight there, if they go up this road and they go straight there, then we'll know God's behind all of this. I don't think I would have at that point been doubtful about whether God was behind all of this. But for some reason, they hung in there with their obstinacy and their pride. But the cows went straight on. The oxen went straight on. And they went first to a town named Beth, what was it? Anybody remember it? Beth Haven, okay. And then they went to, the citizens there decided to send it where? And these were some of those towns that were border towns that we spoke of a little while ago. Now, the next one, Kiriath Jearim, That's how I pronounce it. I don't know how they pronounce it. But Kiriath-Jearim was more toward Jerusalem. It was more away from Philistia. And so we send it there. And how long does it stay? 20 years. And how did it get gone from there? We don't read the story. There's no reason you should necessarily know this unless you read ahead or remember it from another study. It stayed there till David came to get it and take it to Jerusalem. And that was 20 years on down the line. And we'll read about that in 2 Samuel. So that story is still ahead of us. So we send then the Ark of the Covenant in chapter 6. It's taken back to the land of Israel, to the town of Kiriath-Jearim. So in chapter 7 now, what we come to in chapter 7 is a reminder of Samuel's occupation, if you will. What did Samuel do most of the time? He didn't just sit around and prophesy. Priestly duties, he had to engage in them. But what did he do day by day? When he got up and went to work, what did he do? He judged. You recall now, when we go Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, and we go all the way down to Samson, Eli, and Samuel, Samuel was a judge. And so that's what he did. We showed you a slide last time of his circuit. You remember that? And he went to cities like Gilgal and Mizpah and Gibeah, Benjamin, and he just made a circuit. And what he did in each of those cities was he stayed there a while and he settled disputes and issues. He led the people in worship, of course. He was a priest, after all. And so that's what he did. And really, that's kind of what chapter 7 tells us all about. First of all, he initiates some spiritual reforms, doesn't he? If you'll remember, in the opening part, we're told in verse 2, for example, that the ark stayed there those 20 years at Kiriath-Jearim. And then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to the Lord with what? All your heart. And do what? Turn to the Lord with, you have to go toward God and you have to go away from something else. Put away your idols. Put away your Baals and your Ashtoreths then. Put them away and prepare your hearts to serve the Lord and serve Him only, and He'll deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. So, we began then, Samuel begins his work in earnest with a spiritual revival, doesn't he? He is doing a reform of them. Now, this happened over and over and over and over and over in the history of Israel. I mean, it keeps going. By the time we get hundreds of years later to Josiah, you remember Josiah became king when he was 8. We're doing yet another reform. Hezekiah before him had done one. So we'll do this along again and again. The history of Israel, the whole history is kind of like the book of Judges. The book of Judges is sort of a microcosm, if you will, of Jewish history. Up and down, up and down. And so Samuel initiates one of his reforms at this place. And then he does something. God, you remember now, he told them here that if they would do this, in verse 3, he will deliver you. You repent. Turn toward God, turn away from your idols, serve God with all of your heart. And the closing line of verse 3, he will deliver you from the hands of the Philistines. So what he does next then in chapter 7 is what? Burnt offering, and then what? The biggie. He defeats the Philistines, doesn't he? That's what God had promised, and now we carry through on it. So Samuel leads them in a successful campaign against the Philistines, and we're told that the aftermath of that was what? Philistines didn't bother him anymore during Samuel's lifetime. So not only did he defeat them, but God, of course, was the one doing the defeating, but he gave them peace from the Philistines all of Samuel's life, and that was probably a good number of years, if you will. So, we have that then. Well, all of this topsy-turvy. Guy, did you have a point? Yes, yes. They retook several of their border cities over there that they had fought with the Philistines over. Exactly. Now then, though, they have defeated the Philistines, and yet the people are still weary of all of this turmoil, all of this up and down, and what do they think will solve that? Huh? Have a king. So, chapter 8, what happens? Chapter 8, what happens? I sound like an echo, don't I? They asked for a king. They demanded a king then. That's what they were tired of, all of this back and forth. And so they demanded a king. Now, Samuel told them the downside of all that, didn't he? He told them what was going to happen to them if they had a king. But their response was, no, we want a king. So in chapter 9, what happens? In chapter 9, God introduces Samuel to a fellow named... and so now one of our principal characters. We've got three main characters in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, and they are Samuel, and now the next one is Saul, and the next one is David. These are the three main characters in these books. So we meet, and we don't have time, I wish we did, to go into all the details of this story. We've already done that, but it's a terribly interesting story. But just to sum it up, God introduces Saul to Samuel. They meet, and God tells him, you anoint this man. Now, the people are still voicing their opinions about it, and Saul's a great big strapping, handsome kind of guy. Some of us know how he felt. And he was, anyhow, he was very impressive. And so the people were drawn to him, and he did some rather significant things, as we have noticed, and was a humble man, it appeared, at the first. And so in chapter 9, Samuel brings Saul to his home, and in that setting ultimately anoints him. Chapter 10, what happens then? The official anointing of Samuel comes in chapter 10. And then in chapter 11, what do we have? We have Saul making a very impressive beginning, don't we? Makes a very impressive beginning. What he does is he subdues a nation. They've not been having much problem with the Philistines, but they're having problems now. At least one of their cities across the Jordan, over in the territory called Gilead. The town is called Jabesh of Gilead. Sometimes on a map you'll just see Jabesh, but it's in the territory of Gilead. So Jabesh Gilead it is called. And who had besieged it? The Ammonites, and they were, of course, a Transjordan tribe, weren't they? Moab, a little south of them, then Ammon, and Ammon bordered on the territory of Israel that was east of the Jordan. And they had surrounded Jabesh Gilead, and what does Saul do about that? He goes and delivers them. He whoops up on them, as Andy Griffith would say, didn't he? They just trounced Ammon, and in fact, after the battle was over and everybody was running, there were enough of them for two guys to run together. And it was that bad. What impression do you think that made on Israel? Yeah. They believed God had chosen this man, and God had chosen this man. So they were impressed with that, and there had been some naysayers about him to begin with, but now the feeling is so strong for him that some of those who are for him want to kill those guys who opposed him at first. And then we come back, and what we do is sort of reaffirm the kingdom and reaffirm Saul as king at the end. Just a little short thing about verses 12 through 15 at the end of chapter 11 then. Then in chapter 12, what do we have? Kind of a sad scene in one way, isn't it? We have Samuel's farewell address to the people. It serves as sort of an official coronation of Saul. We've anointed him and we've reaffirmed him, and now this is sort of an official coronation, a changing of the baton, if you will, and Samuel sort of officially turns over the leadership. He says, look, you know how I've lived among you. I've tried to be honorable. I've tried to have integrity. Anybody have a charge to make against me? And they didn't. They affirmed what he said. So he is quitting his role as leader in full accord, of course, with the plan of God, but leaving on a good note because he has been an honest and honorable man in all the years he's dealt with him. And he hands then the leadership over to Saul. And that's where we are today. Okay? And we're just looking at, I say, the first 15 verses of this chapter. So let's turn over there then and look at it. And again, I say, since we didn't get the overhead going, just let's look at the text here and let's see what happened. Now, verse one is a problem. And it's a problem because words have gotten left out in most of the ancient manuscripts. And so the one I have, this is, what is this? I think this is the New King James. Yeah, this is the New King James. And the way it reads in verse 1 is, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, then he chose his standing army. Now, other translations do other ways. Anybody have one that says when he ruled 30 years, it says that he ruled 30 years, and then he ruled, his total rule was 42? You have one, anybody have one that says that? Something close? That's one of the translations that's given of it. And we're not going to settle that simply because the ancient manuscripts just somehow, some information got left out of them. And so when it gets left from one, the next copyist comes along. And most of those copyists in those days, it was a sacred work. They were not going to put anything there that wasn't there. Occasionally somebody may have, but that was their commitment. And so we wind up with a bunch of manuscripts that don't have apparently enough information for us, so I'm not going to take a hard stance on this. It just seems to me that what we're saying is that Saul ruled a year, and after 2 years, he selected his standing army, and that's what's going on now. How many does he select? 3,000. He selects 3,000 men. Now, this is not his total army, but this is kind of the central army, his standing army. And they sort of they're sort of his extended bodyguard, almost, you could say. How many of them does he command directly? 2,000, and so that would leave how many for somebody else to direct? 1,000. And who is the somebody else? We're meeting him for the first time now. Jonathan. Who is Jonathan? He is Saul's son, isn't he? And what Jonathan does, and I don't know whether he knew this was going to happen or not, but he precipitates a really scary situation. What does he do? He sacks a Philistine garrison, doesn't he? At Geba or Geba, I'm not sure how they pronounce that. But of course, they had outposts, camps, garrisons, and translations will render it one way and some the other. But Jonathan did was he went and he took one of these. And that was kind of like poking a stick in a hornet's nest, wasn't it? You ever done that? Me neither. I did knock a wasp nest down one time, and I regretted that. Just between you and me, I regretted that. In fact, I was so smart that I never did do that again. I pick up on things real quick. Well, that's what Jonathan did. Jonathan poked a hornet's nest, didn't he? And what did the Philistines do? Yeah, they got an army together. Now, let me just mention one thing here, and we won't dwell on this. In all of especially the history books that are here, like 1 and 2 Samuel, and 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles, we are constantly running into issues involving numbers, okay? And again, we're not going to solve all of those issues. Part of the problem is that some of their numbers, and if I had my overhead, I would show you an illustration of it, but their numbers look so much alike that it was easy to read one for the other. And so my translation, as I recall, this translation says that the Philistines came at them with, I believe, 30,000 chariots. That's a lot of chariots, folks. And then they had 6,000 horsemen, and then they had foot soldiers as plenteous as the sands on the seashore. Now, I don't know whether this is just simply a hyperbole and exaggeration to make a point that they were overwhelming. You may have a translation that says there were 300 or 3,000 chariots. You might have one that says 300. You might have one that says 30, because there are translations that say each one of those. It's not a great big deal. That's not the point of this at all. They had an overwhelming, overpowering army, and they were scared slap silly, weren't they? I mean, what'd they do? Huh? They hid. They got in caves. They got in thickets. They got in cisterns. They got in pits. Anywhere they could hide, they went and hid. Some of them even ran away, didn't they? Where'd they go? They went across the Jordan over into Gad and the southern regions of some of the tribes that were across the Jordan. They were just scared to death, weren't they? Anybody here blame them? I'd have probably told the fellow in the nearest hole, move over. So they were frightened. It was a terrible kind of scene, wasn't it? When we finally, though, Saul and those with him, some stayed with him to their credit, said they were trembling. My translation says, yours may say something else, but they were scared, but they did stay in spite of their fear with Saul. So apparently Samuel had told Saul, you go to Gilgal and you wait 7 days and I'll come, and then we'll approach God, we'll worship God, we'll do what we need to do, and then we'll go into battle. Could they have won? Sure, no question about that. We know God didn't even need Israel to beat the Philistines, did he? But he would use this contingent to do that. And by the way, that time in chapter 10, verse 8, where God tells Saul to wait 7 days, that's not the same instant. A bunch of stuff happens in between, if you just read in between. For example, the battle against the Ammonites occurs in between those times. So that's not the same time, but it does illustrate the kind of thing that had been told Saul. Now, we don't know. The text doesn't tell us precisely when Samuel told Saul this, but he was told to wait there. I will come and I will offer the sacrifices. You'll wait. That was a heavy part of this requirement. You wait and then I'll come and I will, God will deliver us, is the implication of all of that. How did Saul feel about that? He waited 7 days. Did he wait 7 whole days? That's the problem. He waited until the seventh day, I think, is the problem. And Samuel hadn't come by the time Saul thought he should come. But remember, Saul calls for two offerings. He calls for the burnt offering, and he calls for the peace offering. And he finished the burnt offering, and what happened? Samuel came. So Samuel wasn't late as far as missing the date. He just was later than Saul thought he should have been. And so Saul then called for these elements to make these sacrifices, and he made them. And Samuel came and said, what have you done? And Saul gave him three excuses, didn't he? He said, first of all, everybody was running, weren't they? He said that you were running late. He said the Philistines have gathered a great force against us, and we hadn't yet sought God's favor. He gave him those four excuses. What did Samuel say to that? You have done foolishly. And as a result, what happened? God said, your dynasty, your family will not continue on the throne. I have chosen a man after my own heart who will take the throne. And we'll take up that as we go along. God bless you. Thank you. I love you. And I'm sorry we're just about a minute, 30 seconds to a minute late. But we did pretty well, didn't we? We covered 13 and a half chapters. We did pretty well. And besides that, they rung my bell early. See? Those preachers always got an escape, haven't they?